Greetings, creeps, and welcome to episode 24 of the Slashings podcast. I'm your host, JR, and this is where we discuss horror's influence from the silver screen and beyond. This intro is being recorded on Monday, February 1st, and the following interview was recorded on Tuesday, January 19th. I've talked about horror punk and its importance to me before in the Davey Calabrese episode, and today I'm joined by one of the most integral parts of so many horror punk groups, and again feel the need to express my love for that particular strain of punk. Another important vein of this episode is the Art of the Wax Museum. Growing up and living in central Massachusetts gives me access to a pretty solid array of museums of and about the macabre. In Salem, Mass., you have Count Orlok's Nightmare Gallery hosting an insane set of primarily modern horror characters displayed artfully and lovingly. You have the Witch Trial Museum hosting recreations of the infamous trials. If you head south and west of here a little bit, you'll find the Witch's Dungeon, owned and operated and loved by Cortland Hull. We talk about that one a lot in the following interview, and both Goolsby and Mind reverence for that place is palpable in the audio. So when the gates of the Witch's Dungeon open up, pop on Goolsby's Nosferatu score and take a trip. I promise you it's worth it. Welcome to this week's episode of the Slashings podcast. I'm joined by Argyle Goolsby. How's it going, man?
I'm good, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, of course. For anybody who doesn't know, would you mind introducing yourself a little bit?
Yeah, man. I'm Argyle Goolsby. I was born in September of 19... no, I'm just kidding. I'm a musician, artist, all around jack of all trades, I like to think of myself. So
absolutely. And as far as just labeling yourself as a musician, you've had such a long career almost entirely in the horror punk genre, most famously with Blitzkid, but you've dabbled into like so many other major horror punk bands as well. So not only are you the pioneer of one of the biggest bands of the genre, but you've been sort of behind the scenes with all the other bands involved in it as well. It's been crazy.
Yeah, man, I've been busy.
Understatement.
It's been a busy 20 plus years, dude. You know, it all started with Blitzkid. You know, I mean, that was, I never really had planned on being in a band. I never, you know, grew up saying I want to be in a band. I love bands, you know, I loved music, but you know, I there really wasn't much opportunity where I was from. I'm really lucky that I met Tracy, you know, TB Monstrosity, because that was just a complete chance. Had we not met, I mean, I really don't know if I would have pursued being in music, because I was more into art and, you know, I wanted to do a lot of stuff with that. And, you know, I was already in college when Blitzkid started. So, you know, I was already like dealing with, you know, all of that and what I was doing with my career, and it all just shifted. So, you know, but it's been cool because it allowed me, you know, Blitzkid allowed me to do, and being in a band's allowed me to really, you know, find a lot of expression with art that, you know, probably otherwise I wouldn't have been able to find if it wasn't for music. So.
And obviously Blitzkid's entire career is all horror focused. When did you yourself start getting into horror as a genre?
Oh man, that goes way back. My, like, you know, earliest memories were just going to the library and seeing books on horror movies. The Crestwood House monster books, those were big when I was in school, like in the library, the orange and black monster books. So I started seeing like imagery, you know, as early as like kindergarten, right? But I think before I really got into like the horror genre of movies, what really did it for me was a book. And I have it right here. I'm going to go get it real quick so I can show you. It's literally right here. Hold on one second. So that's how big of an inspiration it is for me, because I have it on hand. It's like right there. When I was a kid, like I was probably about, I guess, like 4 years old. I got this book called Grandpa's Ghost Stories by James Flora.
That art's sick.
Yeah, man. And it scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. Like, I'm serious, man. This book terrified me, bro. And for the longest time, you know, like, because I lost it. So, you know, when I was, I mean, by the time I was old enough to really remember, you know, like, stuff, I was in school, like, you know, elementary school. It was gone. I don't know what happened to it. It must have just gotten lost or something. But for the longest time, I thought I imagined the book, because that's how young I was when I saw it. And I just had these vague inklings of pictures that I had seen that like were really like, I don't know, like impressionable on me. And I was like, for the longest time, not sure if I ever even, if the book existed. And, you know, when Google became a thing and the internet, I started trying to find it. And I spent years looking for it, but I didn't know how to search for it. And then one day, I wasn't even looking for this book. I was looking under a different artist. I was looking up an artist, and James Flora, the artist in this book, popped up, and I saw the cover of it, and I knew immediately that that was the book. You know, I was like, that's it. And then I found it on eBay. It's like an old library book. I managed to get this one for like $150. But I mean, they go for like $500 to $600, this book, man.
Damn.
Mainly because the author, James Flora, was like a really renowned artist in the jazz world. He did, back in the 50s and 60s, like most of the jazz albums. Like any covers that you saw with like this, his style, if you look him up, you'll know what I mean. He was the guy. So his stuff's really sought after for that reason. But before I get like all like on a sidetrack book and everything, that's what did it for me, right? So like that kind of opened it up for me. That's when I started getting scared, and I enjoyed it. I was like, this is fun. And then I started seeing the books in school, and then that just turned into, you know, whatever, you know. I think the big turning point, or another big turning point, was probably about like 1986. I'm dating myself here, but you know, VCRs, you know, you can rent them. Back then you had to rent them, and they were super expensive to own. So I would rent VCRs, and I would rent horror movies. Because, I mean, where I lived at the time, you know, even with cable, they didn't show anything. You might see something on AMC every now and then on like Friday or Saturday night, but it was like super late, and like there was no real like TV guide or anything like that where I was. So you just kind of had to chance it. But then what happened was VHS started becoming available, you know, like in outlet markets, like Kmart, Rose's, Hills department store, and stuff like that. And that's when I started collecting horror movies. The first one I got was Phantom of the Opera, and it was Good Times Video. It was on VHS. And I remember when I saw it too, because I was in Kmart and I was with my dad, and the VHS was new. That was a whole new, you know, thing in the store. You know what I'm saying? It's just like when computers became like the new technology in the store, they're like, wow, a computer department. It was like, wow, VHS. And you know, I started looking at them, and the artwork on these boxes were, you know, amazing, man. You know what I mean? Like, it's a lot of it was replications from the original movie art, the, you know, the lobby cards, the posters. And, you know, that's how I found out about a lot of movies, too. I mean, I'd, you know, as I said, I'd see stuff on TV, or I'd see things in books, but now I had this whole VHS display of, like, literally, man. I mean, if I can remember without feeling like I'm exaggerating it, it was probably, I mean, like, at least 100 VHS. And, you know, there, I was seeing movies like Day of the Triffids, and, like, Man Beast, and, like, Hammer horror movies that I didn't even know existed. That's where I found out about them, was VHS boxes. So I would make notes on a little notepad. You know what I'm saying? Like a little notepad and a little pencil while I was in Kmart. And I would write down these titles. And these are the things that I wanted. You know, and then I'd just save up my money, man. And I'd go back and I'd buy these VHS whenever I had money. And then the collection started that way. You know what I'm saying? And I mean, I amassed a pretty good collection by the time DVDs rolled around. You know, like I already had a couple hundred VHS at that point, because even when I was a kid, you know, I was collecting to a degree. And then when, you know, I was like 20, 21 years old, whatever, and people started like trading in all their VHS for DVDs, like at the record stores, like I was just buying them up. So, and I still had a really big collection. But that's where it all started for me, man. That's where the whole horror thing started. It started with books, and then, you know, it started with VHS. And then in the middle of that too, were books again. You know what I mean? Like I've always loved like literature and stories and all that stuff. So any chance I could get to buy like an illustrated Edgar Allan Poe book, like, you know, abridged for kids and shit like that at Walden Books, I would buy it. Yeah, that's where all my money went, man.
I feel like that's such an important part for like most horror fans too, is the collecting side of like, I'm looking around, I've got my shelf of like hundreds of DVDs and Blu-rays over there. I'm surrounded by all of my toys and goodies and stuff. What are some of your current gems of your horror collection?
Well, I have a signed Basil Gogo's print.
Well,
so that, and yeah, that's, I got it hanging up on the wall over here. But I had gotten that about 2 years ago through my friend Cortland, who had worked with Basil Gogos on a number of projects. He had given him a couple of things, you know, a couple of signed things, and it was an extra that he had of Henry Hole, the Werewolf of London, which was my friend Cortland's uncle. So he had that and he gave it to me. So that's kind of a really cool piece that I really like. I've got, you know, pieces of the Evil Dead Cabin that I went and got myself, and I probably got Lyme's disease as a result of it. I just remember leaving that day and just covered in ticks, man. Like, so much so that, like, the guy I was with, my buddy, we just stopped at Walmart and went and got flea and tick shampoo for pets. Literally just took a flea and tick bath in the Wendy's bathroom next to Walmart. I've got that. I've got parts of, hold on, I'll show you. Give me 1 second.
Yeah.
I've got over here. Right here, I've got, this is part of the castle that they filmed Nosferatu in Doni Kub in Slovakia. The castle's called Orava Castle. And back in 2012, my band Blitzkid were in Europe, and we were on our way to Transylvania, to Cluj-Napoca, which is like a city in Romania. We had a show there. And, you know, we had plans to go see, you know, Dracula's castle in Brasov. Well, like, there's like 12 of them, right? But, like, where we were going to be able to see the one in Brasov. And on the way, you know, we were passing through Slovakia. And I was like, guys, we got to stop if, like, we're anywhere near this, you know. Luckily, one of us had the internet on the phone. And we were like, we can do it. And we went, we did the tour. And, you know, we got these hanging around outside. I mean, we weren't like chipping away at it, but there was one part of the castle. I mean, it's like 800 years old, where it was kind of in repair and there was rubble. So we were like, yank. So, I mean, you know, that for me is, that's a cool piece for me. You know what I'm saying?
Now, you had mentioned both Cortland as well as Nosferatu. You've been working a lot recently with Cortland Hall of the Witch's Dungeon to not only like work with the museum itself, but to do the score for their re-release, or for your re-release of Nosferatu. How'd you get started working with Cortland in the Witch's Dungeon?
I met Cortland about 5 years ago when I moved up to Connecticut. You know, I was living down in West Virginia previously to that. And when I got up here, I had a couple of friends who, well, they didn't live in Connecticut anymore, but they were telling me, you know, now that you're up here in this area, there's a place you ought to check out, you know, the Witch's Dungeon. And I'd actually heard of it before, you know, like just in passing, whatever, over the years, but never really amounted to seeking it out or anything. And when I looked and found out that I literally was, you know, like 40, you know, miles away from the place, I went to the website, and it just so happened that I think like the weekend after, you know, the weekend that it was, he was showing King Kong on 16mm. And, you know, I was like, I gotta go. I gotta go see this. And I was all set to go, all geared up to go. And then we got a huge snowstorm and that got canceled. So that kind of got put on hold again until his next showing, which was like 2 or 3 months later. And that's how I met him. I went to the Witch's Dungeon where it was located at the time in Bristol, Connecticut. And to see, I think it was the Black Castle. And just introduced myself, right? And I mean, really, I went every time he showed a movie. That's how it started, you know. I really didn't anticipate that we were going to become as great friends as thankfully we have. But I was just, you know, another person watching movies every time that he showed them. And we just started having conversations, you know. Like, I think I told him about visiting Nosferatu's castle. And I think that, you know, obviously he was interested in that. And, you know, we just kind of picked up that rapport. You know how it is. I mean, you know, when it's two people that are horror movie fans, and even not just movie fans, but just fans of the whole sphere of this sort of stuff, it's easy to just start getting into conversations and it just unravels, man. And, you know, before you know it, I mean, that's the thing, Cortland can talk, man. And I mean that like in a loving way. He's got so many cool stories. Like, I would just, you know, just keep baiting him on for more information and more stories, and you know, we just became friends that way. So
That's really cool. And then it did blossom into one of your more recent releases of doing the rescoring of the original Nosferatu from a print that he had. Was that your first time digging into doing a score for a film?
Yeah, it was. It was. I thought about doing it before, you know. He brought up the idea to me one night after a movie. He said, you know, I have a proposition for you, more or less. He explained to me that he had a really good print of Nosferatu. He had it on 16mm and he had gotten it from a collector some years before. And, you know, in kind of line with what I was saying about him showing movies there, he wanted to show it. It's always something because he was really proud of the quality of the print. He wanted to show it, but silent movies are tricky. Do you know what I mean? Like, if you're not really into silent movies, then they can be hard to watch. And even if you are into silent movies, they can be hard to watch without music. Or worse yet, the wrong kind of music. You know, sometimes you get a lot of like needle drop scores where it's just whatever public domain music is dropped into a movie that really has no association whatsoever with what's happening in that movie. And I told him, I was like, yeah, you know, that's something I literally had a note to do, like one day score Nosferatu. And he's like, if you want to do it, you know, let's do it. And that was pretty much it. I had no real prior experience other than just wanting to do it. So I went home and I just started writing. And I literally took about 2 months where I just didn't do anything else. I just kind of shut myself off from everything else that I was doing and worked on it. And then I got it completed. And then from that point, you know, I started kind of developing it a little more with my friend Chris, who is also the original drummer from Blitzkid that I work with a lot on music. So I'm bouncing ideas off of him and kind of developing things. And that's when we just set up studio time, you know, got it recorded. But the whole process was crazy. You know, it was supposed to be finished within a matter of, you know, like a month or two. And then 2020 happened.
Yeah. So you had a show booked to do that live, like in New Jersey, right? When that was first being wrapped up, wasn't there a Nosferatu show?
We were going to premiere it. In New Jersey in May. So what was happening was at the beginning of the year, Blitzkid had announced that, you know, we were doing a tour, Escape the Grave tour. And that was our first tour would have been our first tour. Still will be our first tour. At the onset of 2020 was going to be our first tour in like nearly a decade. So, you know, obviously like we're super jazzed. We're like ready to go. And this project was already in the pipes. So the way that we decided to just kind of like premiere it was at the end of the tour, you know, our last show was going to be in New Jersey anyway. And we were playing a memorial show for Jason Trioxen, our friend. And we just decided that it might be a cool idea, you know, just if it's going to be a 2-day event, to make one of the things attached to that event being this screening for the movie. And we'd found a theater, which was 2 blocks away from the venue that we were going to be having, you know, the show at. And, you know, we sold tickets. We had 120 seats, pretty small theater, but that's what we wanted. And we sold all the tickets. We sold out. Everything was good to go. We were going to bring a bunch of figures down from the Witch's Dungeon, have them in the lobby. we were going to have our friend Shadow Windhawk dressed up as like Nosferatu walking around, you know, escaping people. And then we were going to premiere it and do like more or less like a little like presentation beforehand, before the screening. And then afterwards, open up the merch table and sell it. But then, as I said, you know, COVID happened and then we tried to reschedule everything. And it's been successful in terms of like getting the tour rescheduled. But the theater that we were at, I think that I'm not sure they survived, you know, the whole lockdown, shutdown thing. So that's why we just ended up we ended up opting to do it virtually on Halloween, just because, I mean, if we keep waiting to put it out, then it could be next year, the year after, who knows, before we actually premiere it. And we're just too excited, you know, just to like sit on it anymore.
As well, you should be. That score was awesome. Like it's arguably the best one to listen to for when you're watching the movie. Now it just fits the theme better. Cause like I have the Kino release of it that I don't know what piano music they had for it, but it doesn't fit the right vibe or the right mood for it. What you put out does fit the film, and it goes like note for note with the movie, like the emotions of the characters, the dialogue itself. You've written it perfectly for it, so thank you.
Well, thank you. I'm glad that you picked up on that, because that was, you know, I labored over those details in writing it. Because, you know, I mean, it's a seminal movie. It's a classic movie. And, you know, the last thing I want to do is, you know, detract from that by, you know, writing something that has, one, either been done before, or, you know, two, writing under, you know, that movie's expectations or what it should have, which was a lot of pressure. You know what I mean? I was so excited when I went into it and started recording. I think that, like, drove the creativity of it. And I'm lucky that I got through that burst of creativity before I started to, like, really realize that what position I put myself in. I was like, wow, I could potentially be ruining one of the best movies ever made. Like, you know what I mean? I was like, it's all subjective, right? But, you know, luckily I got through the writing process before that, so it didn't really, like, trip me up. But that's the thing, man. You know, with movies like that, that's one thing Cortland had talked to me about at the very onset of the project was, he's like, do your thing, do whatever you want. And I want this to be, you know, what you do. His only request was that we incorporate sound effects because, you know, in the early days when they would show these films in theaters, they had someone there specifically to utilize sound effects. So if there's a horse galloping, you know, someone with coconuts over in the corner doing that. And, you know, it added to the experience. And that's one thing that's missing in a lot of these you know, reissues with scores. As I said, I mean, generally, especially in the case of like Nosferatu, where it's public domain, you know, it's like the very minimum work can be done to put it out. You don't really have to really like labor over it if you don't want to. If you take something that's not public domain, then you're paying for a license to use it. So you're probably going to take your time to make sure that it's, you know, everything that it can be. But as I said, in some cases with public domain, people just use it as an opportunity, as a quick buck, quick something to release. And, you know, they suffer for that. But with this one, you know, as far as the sound effects go, it just needed that. You know, like you're talking about Kino. You know, it's a really good print. It's a good reissue. I like what they did with it. The clarity is like super, super awesome. But, you know, even in that one, there's not a lot of, music or sonic related stuff happening to the action. It's not really keyed up very
exactly.
Well.
Exactly. It didn't fit the movie itself. Like it fit for like a time period of the music, yeah. But it's kind of tone deaf to what's happening on the actual film. Which is why yours brings it, like, there's meaning to it. It's fitting the pace of what's happening on screen. It made sense for it. So I really do appreciate that.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, of course. You had released it on Halloween as a streaming event, and that was kind of a double header for you that night because you had that streaming and then the Blitzkid Hollow Stream event too, which was played amongst Cortland's wax statues and Bill Diamond's puppets. It was such a cool thing, and now we're getting a home release of that. But how did the production of that go? Like, how did that sort of come around?
So in terms of All Hallows Stream, the way that all worked out was, you know, going back to Escape the Grave Tour, you know, the onset of 2020, we were poised to go out in April, and we were going to do, I think, like 35 shows across the US. And, you know, that was that. And as I said, it was going to end in New Jersey, and, you know, Corona came in, kicked everybody's ass. We really had no way, as no one did at that point in time, to really gauge the extent of what we were dealing with, like what we're still dealing with. But we just kind of figured that it might be best to reschedule as soon as possible. And we did. So we had originally rescheduled for, I think it was going to be the fall for Halloween. And I think around August, we realized that, you know, this shit isn't getting any better and we're not going to be on the road. And, you know, we knew we would have to announce that. And yet again, disappoint everyone who had already bought tickets and were excited to see us. So we just decided to do something. You know, we were like, look, it's almost Halloween. We're not going to get out and play this year. So, you know, why don't we get together under, you know, the conditions in which we can get together and just do something recorded. And that's how the whole concept came about. And, you know, originally we were going to do it live. You know what I mean? Like, just like as we're doing now. I mean, obviously this will be aired later, but like in terms of, you know, what we're doing, we're just going to do it live. But logistically that was more of a problem because, TB lives down in West Virginia. I live in Connecticut. Benny lives up in Massachusetts. So 2/3 of us live up here you know, in the Northeast quadrant. And that's when the whole idea of, you know, getting Tracy up here kind of like came to be. And, you know, we were just like, well, where are we going to do this? You know, if we're going to do something, we want to do it. We want to make an event out of it. You know, we don't want to just be like in the laundry room of, you know, Benny's basement or whatever, you know what I mean? Like with a couple of posters on the wall, no offense to stuff like that, but we just wanted to do more. And then it just dawned on me. I was like, well, there's the witch's dungeon. You know, I mean, that's pretty close to me. That's pretty close to Benny. And, you know, TB said he could make the trip if we wanted to, you know, organize it. You know, and I got married at the witch's dungeon. Like I know that, you know, sound can be amplified in this place. Cause you know, we had Johnny from Crypt Keeper 5 and, you know, they were playing music and all that stuff at the wedding. So, that was the plan. I approached Cortland and said, this is what we want to do. He said, absolutely, let's do it. And then 4 days later, he told me that he's moving the dungeon. And this is like after we announced that we're going to do it and everything. So, I was like, what do you mean you're moving? Cause at the time where he was, I don't know if you ever saw his, previous location.
Yeah, he had the big movie room in that one. Cause that was, I kind of liked that about the old setup was the tour ended there. I know the new one has one upstairs, but yeah, that old one had that whole movie room. So that's where I thought you guys were going to be like doing the stream or the event.
That was the plan.
Yeah.
So that was the plan was, you know, we thought it would be great. Cause you know, you could go through the tour of the monsters and then at the very end, you come out into the movie room and then we're already there. And then we would play the show. The whole premise was just to keep it kind of tongue in cheek and kind of like sticky and be like, oh, our final attraction, here they are. Like, you know, we're part of the wax figures, like part of the attraction. But when he told me he was moving, which I understood why, you know, he was having some issues in terms of like accessibility at that location for years. He'd been there since 2013 or 14. And prior to that, since 1966 until 2000, I guess it was 13, he was at his old original location, which was his house, which was this really, really small, like Swiss chalet style building out in his backyard. And that's where he was. But for a number of reasons, he had to leave around 2013. He couldn't operate there anymore. And he had friends at the Bristol Historical Society, and they were the ones who, on the board, they were like, well, you can operate here. It can't be year round because we have other things happening here throughout the year that we need, you know, the space for. But they did allot him the time, you know, around Halloween to bring everything down and set up. But that was the big problem was, you know, it was a good location and I liked the way that it was set up, but you know, it couldn't be open year round. And ultimately that's what it should be. It should be a year round attraction. So it was one of those things where, you know, it was getting close to Halloween and he knew that he was going to have to pull his figures out of the attic and set them up. And if he set them up where he was going to take them at the Historical Society, he'd have to take them down again and then move them to a new place and, you know, that whole process. So it was like, let's just forego all that and just go to a new place before the Halloween season. And we got there and, you know, that's the space, you know, we saw the space, everything was pretty much working out the way that we wanted. We said, let's go for it, you know, and that's kind of how the production for that all began.
Cool. And yeah, you still got that set up for the show too, where it did go through the wax tour first and then go to you guys after, which was, it was cool seeing it like, cause I had been to the physical location, the old one and then the new one, and to see it kind of recreated for the show was really neat.
Yeah. Yeah. That, you know, we wanted to share that for people because it's an awesome place, man.
Yeah.
I mean, you've been there, you've seen it. It's, I mean, there's so much there. He's a collector. He spent his whole life collecting these things, you know. And there's always something like he never ceases to amaze me with shit that he has. You know, I mean, just like the other day, he's like, "Oh, here's a letter from Fritz Lang." I was like, "What?" Oh, Fritz Lang wrote me on his 80th birthday. And, you know,
that's insane
artwork. I'm like it's just this. Even today, he posted something on Facebook about, here's an article National Geographic did on the witch's dungeon. I'm like,
no, that dude's nuts. And then, yeah. So you had this, you had the live streaming event. It did really well. You saw a lot of posts about it online, and now you've taken it and put it onto the DVD format as well as a vinyl release that I was really excited to get my hands on. And I did manage to get the initial run of it, which is cool, but it sold out in 9 minutes.
Yeah, go figure. 9 minutes. I can't believe like we I made them available, and then I literally I someone like someone was at the door, like UPS or whatever. So I walked to the door and I came back 3 minutes later, and half of everything was gone. My phone was just it was just going off, man. You know what I mean? Like giving me notifications. It was just like one just big cacophonous like buzz. It wasn't even like a buzz, another buzz. It was just buzzing for 9 minutes. So it was insane, man. I mean, the response was crazy. Yeah. But that's good, man. I mean, you know, this is the first thing that we've put out music wise in Blitzkid since 2011 or 2010 when Apparitional came out.
And even then, like the re-releases have been few and far between. Like the last one, I think, was Five Cellars Below from.
Yeah.
I can't remember when that final re-release was, but obviously Blitzkid fans are crazy. Like I've been trying to get my hands on some of the vinyl too, and it's just impossible now. So I was very happy to even get to grab this one. Cause it's neat in a way that it's a live album, but it almost plays out like a. To say a greatest hit sounds silly, but it was the original set list, I'm assuming, for the tour. So it kind of played out like your guys' greatest hit. So now it's nice to have all of that in one solid album.
Exactly, man. I mean, you know, and what I stress to people, you know, especially when they watch the performance, is some of the comments that we got was like, wow, you guys are a lot more subdued, you know, than I remember seeing you when you were live. Like, why aren't you guys running around? You know, it wasn't like a big issue, but some people brought it up. And one thing that I always stress to people is it's not so much a live show as much as a window for you to watch us record a live album. So, you know what I mean? Like when you're in the studio, you're not doing backflips off the drum riser, you know, because you know, everybody's working in unison. Live, it's completely different, man. You know what I mean? Like playing live with people, that's completely different. Like, you know, that's something we've never worried about. You know, if you miss a note because, you know, you just did a cartwheel across the stage, then that's live, you know? So we call it a live album because we recorded it live. It's not a live show. You know, and keep in mind as well, when we're filming it, it was just us there. So that's where the puppets came in, because Bill Diamond, our friend, he worked for Jim Henson. He worked on Dark Crystal, you know, Labyrinth, all that stuff. Guy's got 4 Emmys, you know, for lighting and set design. And here he is right there, you know, saying, hey, if you guys want to use my puppets for an audience, have at it. And I was like, this is too good, man. Like, it just all added up. What started out as just a show, like something we were going to do on Halloween in a laundry room, turned into, you know, a tour of the longest running, you know, horror museum in the world, followed by a performance with all these crazy puppets to like kind of substitute as our audience. And, you know, we decided once the puppets came in, that element, like, let's just run with it. Like, let's turn this into like a variety show. You know, we knew that we were going to have people. So that's why we started. If you listen to the live record, like when you're watching the performance, you'll hear people laughing, you'll hear like, you know, people jeering and cheering and hurrah and all that stuff. It's meant to be like tongue in cheek. You know what I mean? It's like, there's nobody there. Like we know that, we know, you know that, but like, we're putting this huge crowd, all this like applause just to kind of like go with the whole humor of the fact that there's nobody there. Yeah. You know what I mean?
It reminded me of watching like Alice Cooper on the Muppet Show, like that sort of mentality.
Yes, exactly. I mean, and you know, speaking of Muppet Show, that was for me like personally, like my most favorite part of that whole performance, the whole thing is we realized like, okay, we have all these crazy ass puppets who, you know, are designed by a guy who, you know, trained and learned under Jim Henson. So they kind of have that, you know, vibe to them anyway. And I'm like, he has a Boris Karloff and a Vincent Price puppet. Or Muppet, whatever. And I remember in the Muppet Show, the two old guys, Statler and Waldorf, who would sit up in the balcony and heckle the Muppets the entire time. And I was like, this is a perfect opportunity. So we incorporated those two puppets into that bit to kind of substitute, you know, as those two old guys from the Muppet Show. So for people who haven't seen it, after like about every 4 or 5 songs, you know, on the video, it'll cut to them. And then they do a bit where they make fun of the band and they talk about how horrible we are. booze and all that stuff. And the show.
And it was a lot of fun. I'm looking forward to getting to rewatch it. I didn't get to actually watch it on Halloween, but the day after. So it was that nice, like, continuing that same Halloween vibe up here by getting to watch the show. So it was really neat.
Cool, man. Yeah, well, thanks for checking it out, man.
Of course. What is Halloween like in the Argyle Goolsby household?
Depends. Pre-COVID, Halloween was always a show somewhere. You know? There are very few Halloweens where I haven't been playing a show somewhere. This past Halloween was just, you know, basically moderating and monitoring the live performance and making sure that everything, you know, went well. We more or less crashed the server, which is, it was supposed to air, I think, at like 7 o'clock, if I'm not mistaken. And then the server got crashed because of so many people. We had to set it up and do it a different way. We had to embed the video into YouTube and then basically direct people there. So I was just sitting there, like, you know, biting my nails most Halloween night, just anticipating like complete failure of what we were doing, because it was so out of my element. You know, I got a bass on and I'm playing. I'm not sitting there trying to deal with technology.
But it got delayed, but it did go off without a hitch after that, once the live stream started going and it was available for the day after. So no, it went well. You did good.
Yeah, thanks, man. Yeah, a lot of people, and that's why we put it on DVD, was so many people were like, we want to see it again. You know, they were like, this was a lot of fun. And, you know, we looked at it, you know, everything that we've talked about, taking that into account in terms of the variety aspect show of it being more than just, you know, three guys playing music. We're incorporating all these other elements of fun and, you know, performance into it. We looked at it like, this would be great if this is something that people, you know, show their kids every Halloween, or just watch themselves, you know what I mean? Like the Great Pumpkin or something like that. Just like, if we could somehow assimilate into the fabric of that, that would be cool.
Hell yeah. Well, it's definitely going to be a Halloween tradition here. Well, I mean, I'll be watching it once I get it at the end of February, but it'll be a Halloween tradition here as well. Yeah. Another thing that you've sort of, well, it's something you've done before, but now you've started a new venue to do it in, is the Black Hydra Tattoo Shop in, is it Fitchburg or Lunenburg up around here?
Fitchburg.
Fitchburg. So you're now going to have your own booth there as a permanent tattoo artist, right?
Yeah.
Hell yeah, man. I think they just opened up this week, right?
I think they opened on the 30th. Well, it was a soft opening on the 30th of December. And then, if I'm not mistaken. But yeah, they're open now. They're taking appointments. Everything, you know, there's obviously restrictions involved right now as with anywhere because of coronavirus. But, you know, all that's available on the website in terms of like what's, you know, necessary in order to set up an appointment under those conditions.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited to see some of the tattoos you've done there. When's the last time you did tattoos like on a regular schedule?
Regularly before I moved to Connecticut. So I was working at a tattoo shop called Wufu Tattoo, and that was down in Bluewell, West Virginia. And I was there from 2010 until 2015. And then I moved up here, you know, my whole thing was I just didn't want to go. I had people like asking me like, hey, can you tattoo me? But I don't really prefer to tattoo outside of a shop environment. You know, I kind of have a disdain for like kitchen magicians and stuff like that. It's just make it hard for the whole, you know, art, like people who are like, you know, legitimately trying to progress tattooing. So I just didn't really want to do anything that way. And I didn't know anyone in this area at that time, you know, where I'm at in Connecticut. I've made friends, you know what I mean, at some various places who are tattoo artists, but it really wasn't, I mean, it's kind of a tribal thing, man, you know, not for me, but I liken it to like when you watch Point Break, you know, and it's like locals only, you know, you got the guys like Keanu Reeves, you know what I mean? They were like going to hit you with a surfboard if you try to come in and just be like, I want to surf here. I mean, that's an extreme kind of comparison, but I don't think anyone's going to like try to like attack me or anyone for trying to like, you know, work where you're not known. But I just feel weird going into shops like locally, like, hey guys, let me work here. You know, because 99% of the time, like shops like bands are politics. And I don't have time for that shit, man, at all. And that's what's great about Black Hydra is I've known those guys for over a decade. You know what I mean? I've in one way or another worked with them. It's really funny how I hooked up with them too, man. I mean, it's kind of a long story, but it is interesting. What had happened was I got my apprenticeship back in 2000. So I got out of college. I graduated college in 2000 with master's in fine art, minor in history. And I was like, okay. You know, I was already going to band at that point full time. This was 2000. So we're already into like Terrifying Tales era of the band. I was like, I can go either be an unemployed history or art professor or teacher. I can go get a master's. I'm sorry, I said master's. I have a bachelor's. So I could go get a master's in these things. But at the time, I was having so much fun with music. I really didn't want to spend like 4 or 5 more years in school. You know what I'm saying? So I just opted to fulfill, I guess, my need to do something artistic, you know, like analog artistically with tattooing. And I ended up at a place called Ancient Art Tattoo in Roanoke, Virginia. And I apprenticed there for probably about 2 years. And by apprentice, I mean, I was just taking out trash and buying people cigarettes for a long time. You know, like making sure people didn't get towed out of the parking lot and shit like that. And then it moved into me actually tattooing a little bit. And then I was given the ultimatum at that point. You know, if you're going to tattoo, you need to tattoo. You can't do your band in this at the same time because, you know, this is a full-time job. We got guys in here who this is their life. And if you're off, you know, playing in your band on the weekends and that chairs open up, then it makes it hard for us as a business to do what we need to do. So I understood where they were coming from. They're a lot older than me, a lot more old school about shit. And that's why I elected, rather than move forward with, you know, tattooing, just to like step back and try to revisit it at some point in my life. And from that point forward, you know, it was just Blitzkid, man. You know, that was like Let Flowers Die era on up until, you know, 2010 when Apparitional rolled around. Apparitional is kind of a unique story because when that album came out, we were already on hiatus. We were already, for lack of a better term, broken up. You know what I'm saying? Like the album had been out for a very relatively short period of time in 2010. So at that point, you know, I'm living back in West Virginia again. And one of my friends whom I used to go to school with, you know, I used to skateboard with, all that stuff, I ran into him one night. And he told me that he had a tattoo shop. And I just moved back to the area from, I was living in Massachusetts at the time. And he's like, yeah, dude, just come by and work here. And that's how I ended up at WUFU. I stayed there for about, as I said, 5 years and moved up here and started working with Brad and those guys. I know I'm going in circles, man, but it's like a long, complicated history in terms of me and tattooing. But long story short is I'm back. There was an interim. I just want to throw in, there was an interim around 2008, 2009, where I moved to Massachusetts. TB was living in Massachusetts at the time. I was still down in West Virginia. And I figured, you know, he's up there. I had a friend that worked at a tattoo shop who said they were, you know, they're a musician. They're totally fine with me being gone on the weekends. Like all these things that were issues when I was first starting out were not issues with this guy. He was like, if you need to go out and play, that's fine with me. So I was like, all right, I'm going to go up to this shop, start tattooing again. TB's living in Massachusetts now. So that's going to put us that much closer from a collaborative standpoint. Things are going to be cool. You know, in that regard, as far as Blitzkid, it was great. We were able to work on a lot more together. But the guy who had invited me to come up to work for the shop, you know, I don't want to get into like a big long drawn out thing about him or like badmouth the guy, but he didn't tell the people that he worked with that he was bringing me up to this shop to work with them and become his apprentice or work with them or whatever. So my first day of work, I walk into this tattoo shop and I see 4 other people looking at me like, who the fuck is this guy? And then I'm looking at the other guy that I'm with like, what's the deal, man? Did you not tell them that I'm coming up here? And he's like, oh, you know, no, man. You know, it was just this big mess, dude. And I hung out up there for about 4 months trying to like make something happen under this pretense. I come to realize that like this dude who had brought me into the shop had fallen out of favor basically with everyone in there for a number of reasons. So I was automatically guilty by association. And when I came in with this dude, they were like, this guy's an asshole. And me sitting around there for 4 months waiting to learn how to tattoo or like start tattooing at this place, I started making friends. And that's eventually the people that started working at Black Hydra. So they just left that tattoo shop. I mean, this is like, what, 10 years later to open up Black Hydra. So I've known them and I met them all by accident. You know what I'm saying? It's just weird how it all played out. I mean, you know, I come in there just as some guy who's, you know, moving into their territory, you know, kind of fucking up the rotation for everybody. And now we're like, you know, really, really good friends and constituents. So that's my tattoo story, man.
But I've heard other stories about that former shop too, so I'm glad that the group decision was to start the new one, because Brad and Emily are both super talented artists too. Like, my girlfriend gets tattooed by her all the time. So I'm glad that you guys are all working together now at Black Hydra. And the art and logo was done by former guest of the show, Sam, too. So it's cool to see everything kind of come full circle.
Yeah, Sam's great, man. You know, I just want to point out too that, you know, that I'm not detracting from the shop that they were at in any way, shape, or form. Like, the entire time I was there, everyone that worked at that shop was super awesome to me, man. Super accommodating when they didn't have to be. You know what I mean? I was more or less just like the kid that got, you know, whose mom forgot to pick him up at the skating rink. I just like literally was like this abandoned transplant from West Virginia living at this tattoo shop for 4 months. And I think eventually they started feeling sorry for me and the defenses went down and they were like, well, what's the story? Did you not know that this guy here didn't tell us? I'm like, no, I didn't know any of this shit, man. You know? And the long story short, man, you know, I had to move back to West Virginia and I more or less started working in West Virginia. Lost track. I don't say lost track, but you know, I didn't see them on a daily basis anymore. And when I moved back up to Connecticut, I started seeing Brad all the time because he had started playing in his band Damnation. When I'd known Brad originally and met him, he wasn't playing in a band. So when I moved up here, he's like, yo, I have a band now. Let's start doing shows together. And that's when the whole, you know, I guess like reunion between us two and then Emily and then Matt and all those guys at the shop kind of, you know, reworked.
Sweet. Well, I'm excited to eventually book an appointment there once the world sort of settles down and we can safely do stuff like that again. I know it is safe to do it. I just get paranoid about going out and doing anything.
I don't blame you, man. You know, like, it's not worth it sometimes. Yeah. I mean, you know what I mean? Like, some things you got to do, you know what I'm saying? But there are other things where I try to err on the side of caution just because, like, I just want to go out again, man. You know? And I've always been of the mentality where, you know, I'm not trying to, like, stay home, but it's just like, I don't know if that'll help. But, you know, if that means I can go on tour sooner, then, like, by all means, I'll stay home. You know, if that's what you got to do, then that's what I'll do. Exactly. Whatever puts me on tour sooner, man, that's all I care about.
You know, whatever gets me back in or into seeing Blitzkid for the first time, because I've seen you perform solo. You're actually the last show that I saw down at the Drafters in either Dudley or Webster. And so I was like, I'll see that. I'll see you then. Then I'll see you again in a couple of months in Rhode Island for the Blitzkid show. And then like a month after that Drafters show, whole world just had to stop. So hopefully we can all stay home long enough to get back to the Blitzkid tour.
Yeah, oh my God, man. Yeah, you just put that into perspective for me. That was the last show I played.
Oh, shit.
That was the very last performance I've had on stage. Was, yeah, that was what, the end of 2000? No, that was probably February of 2020, like last February.
Wasn't it? It was mid-February. Yeah, almost a year ago. Well, it'll be a year ago by the time this episode comes out.
Dang, man. Like, it feels so freaking weird. Yeah. Because, you know, the All Hallows Stream thing is great. You know, don't get me wrong. Like, that was a lot of fun. But, you know, it was a production. You know, it wasn't live. So, like, I missed that aspect of just walking on stage and, you know, anything can happen.
Exactly. So, hopefully we'll get back to that soon. Are you working on any other projects now? I guess I should rephrase that. You did the score for Nosferatu. Are there any ideas of doing other scores for films in the kind of downtime?
Yeah, downtime isn't a word that exists in my world, unfortunately. You know, it's a blessing and it's a curse, man. I'm in no shortage of projects right now. I've kind of got a lot of things happening right now. You know, a lot of music. I'm working on new Argyle Goolsby like stuff. I have an album. It's already finished. It's just, I would have already been into the, you know, production phase of it for this year had, again, Corona not happened. So it slowing everything down in 2020 made the Nosferatu project slow down. So thus, everything that was happening after that is, you know, all scheduled now. But my plan is to get a new record out. I've got a lot of stuff that I'm working on with Cortland at, you know, the Witch's Dungeon. We've got some projects that we're working together on, like non-music related, non-movie related. But as far as movies are concerned, the scoring, yeah, he's got a lot of other films. The main thing that I want to do right now is, now that we've got Nosferatu out of the way, and I don't want to say out of the way, but I should say like in the bag, we want to look at the other two main ones of that genre, as far as I'm concerned. And that's, you know, kind of Dr. Caligari and the Golem, Der Golem. You know, there are others from the Expressionistic school as well. I mean, I don't want to limit it to that, you know, like Waxworks.
Those are the big three.
Yeah, you know, Waxworks, you know, that's not necessarily, you know, I mean, that's Paul Linney. And that was at a different point in time. Expressionism as, you know, German Expressionism as it's known to be and understood now, I mean, that was already done. As was the case with, you know, Metropolis by Fritz Lang. You know, that was way after the demise of German Expressionism. But those movies really do retain a lot of the, you know, essence of those films. Maybe not as much as like the absolute abstractions those films have, but I mean, it's so clear that Paul Linney and, you know, Fritz Lang were in some way, shape, or form associated with that school of, you know, movie making and cinematography. So I eventually want to do those as well. But as far as the big three most known true expressionistic movies, you know, those are the ones for me, like, as I said, Nosferatu, Cabinet, and The Golem. So it's a toss-up right now which one we're going to do in terms of The Golem or, you know, Cabinet. But it's not going to end there either, you know. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff that I want to work with. He's got a really, really great print of Dante's Inferno, which I don't even think is out on DVD.
I don't think so either.
I don't even know if it's released, but it has no music to it, so... I mean, we got, like I said, a whole list of stuff that he and I are going to work on in regards to that. But we've also been talking about, once everything is, you know, cleared up for travel again, to start taking not only this score, this Nosferatu score, on tour, but do it in conjunction with the Witch's Dungeon. So what we're going to do in that regard is he and I will go out with the figures, you know, however many that we take. It just depends on, you know, where we're going, and do residencies at places. For example, you know, if we were to do something at the Stanley Hotel in Estes Park, Colorado, you know, they have a music hall there, and they also host all sorts of, you know, like residencies. So if that were the case, we would go there for a week. You know what I mean? We would leave the figures up in whatever display area that they have each night, do a show in terms of like the presentation on Cortland's end. And then end that in the music hall with, you know, a live screening of the movie with me and whatever ensemble I'm able to set up for this, playing the score live to the movie. So that's something we want to do. You know, we want to do that, you know, not just at places like, you know, the Stanley where you could have a residency, but just places that aren't even necessarily venues. For example, like, you know, the Museum of Natural History in Los Angeles, they have a lot of Lon Chaney's props on display. You know, they have his, you know, from The Unknown. They have a lot of his stuff. They have the mask from The Phantom of the Opera that he wore, the original, like when he's masked and has the kind of sculpted eyes and the cheesecloth grill across the mouth. So little places like that. So, you know, we're trying to cross over into, you know, doing film and music kind of residencies and exhibitions. So it just depends on whenever all this, you know, allows for something like that.
Sweet. Well, I'm looking forward to it. I will gladly go see that as a full exposition show. I mean, I'll drive down to the Witch's Dungeon whenever I get the chance to, so I would love to see it on a full presentation with the live score.
I appreciate it, man. And I know that one thing that we definitely have planned, this was planned before, again, coronavirus. This is the whole theme of this, you know, podcast right now. But I know, I think it's Rhode Island TerrorCon. Are you familiar with that one?
Yep.
So whenever that is coming back, I know that he's going to be there, and it's going to be quite a get together, man. His booth is going to have, I think, Rico Browning. And he's going to have Sarah Karloff, Victoria Price.
Oh, that's awesome.
Bela Jr., Linda Blair. I think I said Butch Patrick. There's a couple more that he's going to have. But either way, they're all going to be kind of like allotted in one area. And he's going to have, Bill Diamond's going to bring down parts of like a backdrop of a castle with alcoves. And behind each of these people, they're going to put the respective figure of, you know, that person, family or estate. Oh, Lon Chaney, the third. Yes, thank you. Ron Chaney.
Yeah, there we go.
So behind Ron Chaney would be the Wolf, Cortland's Wolfman figure. Behind Victoria Price would be either his Professor Jared or, you know, Dr. Fives figure. Sarah Karloff, either, you know, Ardeth Bay or the monster. So, and then when everyone comes into that room, you know what I mean? It's just one big fell swoop. You go across the table, meet everyone, and I'll be there with them at the table as well. So that's pretty cool, man.
That's insane.
Yeah, man, I'm looking forward to it. So I know he's going to be putting out, I don't know if you saw part one. Part one as it is. He put a DVD out some years ago called The Aurora Model Kit Craze. Mm-hmm. And it's a really great documentary, man. I mean, he knows so much about this stuff, dude, as I said. But it came out a few years ago. He and Bill Diamond had put it out. And you know, it goes over for anyone who hadn't seen it. Just the whole craze of the Aurora Monster model kits in the 60s and how that kind of like precipitated the whole resurgence of, you know, monsters and the craze and monster kits and famous monsters and, you know, all that stuff. And he's wanted to do part two. I know he has a lot of interviews already scheduled. He has one with Bill Mumy, you know, from Lost in Space. I think he's got some stuff with Christopher Lee. I mean, because he had done a lot of these interviews a long time ago, right? Like, so these are like kind of some leftover interviews that he's adding on to. But the point in all that is Zachary was the host of the original one. And unfortunately, Zachary is, you know, not with us anymore. But as for the second one, I guess I'll be hosting it. I'll be the horror host of the second one. And yeah, I'll be in my whole, I've got the whole thing going on, man. Basically, when you saw me at the Witch's Dungeon, how I was dressed up, I had that whole get up with the fingers and the, you know, coat and tails and all that stuff. So as it stands, you know, when that comes out, I'll be hosting it as well. So that's another kind of thing that's in the pipe right now. So
awesome. Well, I'm very much looking forward to that. Conventions are one of the biggest things I miss right now, and I'm really hoping to get back to that in some sort of safe way soon as well. So that'll be one of the big ones I'll get to go to, because that's Rhode Island will be right around the corner. So perfect. We have been going for a little bit. Let's go ahead and start to wrap things up. Where can people follow you online?
Online, Instagram, you can find me at, there's a number of accounts because there's a number of projects, but you can find me at Argyle Goolsby on Instagram. There's also Official Blitz Kid on Instagram. There's a course with No Name Productions, which is ACWNN Productions on Instagram. And then for the Witch's Dungeon, we have the Witch's Dungeon on Instagram. And then on Facebook, it's basically all the same thing. They just said, but, and you know, if you need to reach out to us, a lot of the times, like, we're unable to really respond to messages on social media as much as we'd like. So email is info@acwnnprod.com. And website is acwnnprod.com. and then the store is acwnnstore.com. And yeah, that's kind of where we're at. I'm sorry that this heater is like waiting on it. Like, I don't know if you can hear that or not.
Yeah, it's just adding some creepy ambiance to the end of the episode. We're good.
It's like literally right next to the iPad, so I apologize.
No worries, man.
Thank you all so much for listening, and I hope you enjoyed our accompaniment of the haunted heater at the end there. The Witch's Dungeon will be opening for Dracula's Valentine February 12th through the 14th of this year, so please stop by and check it out. You never know which ghost host may be lurking around the figures. As far as Goolsby and Blitzkid go, they did just release a whole bunch of shirts, patches, pins, masks, and more on their site, as well as Valentine's Day cards. What better way to say I love you than with some gore? A question I was asked via my Instagram was which was my favorite Ramon song and why. I thought a horror punk flavored episode was the best venue for this question. If I had to pick one, I'd probably have to say Pinhead. I love the "you're one of us" mentality, bringing together freaks. Whether it's Todd Browning's or myself, the unity felt cool. Thanks, Patrick. He runs the Instagram page Monsters Holding Bitches, and it's one of my absolute favorites. That's all I have for you this week. I'll be back with two more. Until then, long live the horror, and keep it creepy.